All About Food. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's going to be a really good one. I promise you. Such an important topic. I have with me Sarai Stancic, MD.
Sarai Stancic is a board-certified physician and the subject of the recent documentary film Code Blue. From 1999 to 2006, Dr. Stancic served as chief of infectious diseases at the Hudson Valley Veterans Administration Hospital in New York. During those years, she treated hundreds of patients with viral hepatitis and HIV and directed the MOVE program, a federal VA initiative to encourage healthy lifestyles in veterans. She later joined the viral hepatology team at Roche and conducted clinical studies for new, more efficacious treatment for hepatitis infections. During these research years, she continued to see patients at the Bronx Veterans Administration Hospital in New York City. In 2012, in response to her personal experiences as a multiple sclerosis patient, as well as a veteran physician, Dr. Stancic founded one of the first lifestyle medicine practices in the country, where she created a distinct, contemporary healthcare model rooted in traditional medical principles. Dr. Stancic's current practice focuses on educating and empowering patients to understand the importance of the personal lifestyle choices discussed in the book we are going to talk about today, What's Missing from Medicine. She mentors medical students and residents and seeks to contribute to initiatives centered in redefining the healthcare paradigm. She is a fellow of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine.
You may remember her. We talked about her documentary Code Blue a little over a year ago, which if you haven't seen it, you absolutely must for many reasons. She's got a new book called What's Missing from Medicine. Such a great title. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Karen, it's wonderful to be with you once again, and I'm so excited to be talking about this book. This has been a labor of love, and I'm so excited to release it and hope that it does some good, that it acts as, in many ways, a doctrine that supports patients or and individuals on their personal journeys. You know, we can all do this. These are relatively simple modifications, and they're so powerful. My hope is that I've written something that is, it feels like a conversation between myself and the reader. It's simple, and it's powerful, and hopefully, and that's what we want. We want to empower individuals across the country and beyond to engage in these lifestyle modifications to improve their overall well-being. We want people to live their optimal potential and then we're all at the end of all this, we will pass on, but it can be on our own terms.
I love how you say we can all do this. So this is Dr. Stancic here, everyone, giving you permission. You can do this, whatever it is. If you're in some sort of health crisis, there are many things that you can do. And we're going to talk about your own personal journey with multiple sclerosis. But the wonderful thing about all of the things that you recommend in your book is they apply to just about everything in life and just about most illnesses that people are experiencing today, all these chronic diseases that are raging. So let's start at the beginning. At the book, the beginning, you've got this wonderful foreword by Dr. Dean Ornish.
Yes.
And what I love about what he basically says is that chronic diseases are all the same. They may manifest themselves differently, exactly. But the cause or the causes are all very similar.
And another reason why this is all simple, right? The catalyst for all of this is that unique source of inflammation, right? And how it's expressed in each and every one of us, that's where the genes play a role, right? What are our genetic predispositions? But at the end of the day, heart disease, autoimmune disease, cancer, all of these chronic diseases, dementia that we're witnessing today in our country, the root cause is inflammation. And inflammation is how does inflammation come to be? How is it introduced and what fuels it? It is largely our lifestyle choices. You know, what are we eating? Are we engaging in physical activity? How are we interpreting the stress in our lives? Are we sleeping effectively? What are the substances that we're ingesting? Are we smoking? Are we drinking too much? These are real questions that we need to ask ourselves. And then importantly, and sometimes not discussed the importance of social connections. Mm. We know those amongst us who are isolated and depressed, that fuels chronic disease and leads to premature death. And right now is a difficult time because we're in the midst of this COVID-19 pandemic. So many of us are isolated, but we have modern technology. So opportunities like Zoom and FaceTime, they should be utilized now more than ever because we have to remain connected. It's so important for our overall health and well-being.
I express my gratitude almost every day for Zoom.
Me too.
For Zoom. Thank you, Zoom. Where would we be without
Zoom?
Who
knew Zoom would become this important?
Who knew? Well, somebody knew.
Somebody knew.
And enabled it for us to use in this difficult time. Okay, so let's jump into the book. And as you mentioned, this is a very easy book to read. And I don't know you that well. I've met you in person at your documentary at the premiere in New York of Code Blue. But I feel like it's you speaking. It really does feel that way. And it's easy, it's comfortable, it's friendly. You encourage play through exercise. You're just promoting something that is so positive and easy. And this is really important, especially for people that are faced with a health crisis. Yeah. Very scary. We've both been through them, so we know. And to know that there are things that you can do that don't seem insurmountable. Right. And as you say early in the book, small and consistent changes matter. Find a way to play.
Yes.
Really.
Yes.
So it's inviting almost.
Yeah. And I think that's an important message because so many of us, when we are trying to introduce a change in our lives, we try to do everything overnight. And if we don't get it done in the first few days or first week, then we feel like we failed and then we give up and we move and we fall into our old habits. And I think the important thing is that one small step, just one change in the right direction is so, so powerful. And we need to give that a lot of value because it really is, it's that seedling that you plant. And it may take some time to flourish, but we have to be patient. I think that's, you know, the American way is to be impatient. We want everything overnight. And the most meaningful things in life, if you think about it, are those that we cultivate, that we love, and that we're patient and forgiving. Those are the most powerful accomplishments that we have in life. And so I think lifestyle modification is really about, and the principles that I describe in the book, it's really about being patient and kind and going at your pace, what is suitable and comfortable for you. And in clinical practice over the past several years, as I've done this, I think the most successful patients are those that come in knowing that this is going to be a journey. This is not a quick race. This is a marathon. And I want people to enjoy it. Every small step in the right direction and even every small failure or obstacle comes before us is a moment for an opportunity for us to learn from it and strengthen and try again. It's okay to take a step forward and then take two back. It's okay as long as you don't leave it there, right? Now what were the challenges? What obstructed my forward movement? We learn from that. We're stronger. We move forward.
Life is a journey, and I think we should be learning every step of the way until it's over.
Absolutely, absolutely. The very last breath, we're learning, right?
Yes.
Absolutely. If you think you've learned everything you need to learn, then you're mistaken, my friend.
You talk about the six spokes of lifestyle medicine, promote prevention and healing, food, exercise, stress, sleep, substances, and connection. I'm going to focus on a few of them. Maybe we won't get to all of them. This program is called It's All About Food. We always talk about healthy, whole food, plant food, minimally processed food. I'm a longtime vegan and I promote people eating plants. So we don't have to focus on that just now because I think there are some really important things in your book that I don't hear about enough.
Yeah.
But before we get there, I'm noticing, so this is an audio program and we're recording it with video, and I'm noticing there's this little shopping cart behind you with little like fruits and vegetables. I'm just curious about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, that shopping cart was something from my office that I would have in the office. And in it, I typically would keep lots of items you might pick up at the supermarket, and I would utilize it looking at labels to teach patients. So that's just a remnant and I also, as you've read through the book, I like to play. So that's part of, that whole making the environment in my office just welcoming. I would often have patients bring their children, because lifestyle mm-hmm. medicine is also about family, right? It's not just like, mm-hmm. I don't want folks to make, and well, it's not even that I don't want to, it's difficult to make changes alone. It's important for family to be involved in all of this. So yeah. It's wonderful when I have a patient come in who has some goals that, they want to address their hemoglobin A1C, they're diabetic and they're struggling with the management of that disease, but they come in, I always invite them to bring their significant other or whoever they feel is important in their life to support them, because behavioral modification is all about support. So sometimes they bring their children. And so it's important for us to educate their children or whomever it is that they bring.
I love that. And I agree it's important. I know that when I was going through my advanced ovarian cancer journey, I always had somebody with me, either at my doctor's appointments or even during my chemo treatments.
So
made a big difference. And I'm grateful for all of you who joined me in that journey. It meant so much. And you also grocery shop with your patients.
You, yeah.
Who does that?
Some of us do. Yeah, there's some lifestyle medicine docs out there. And it's fun. It's really, and you learn a lot in that experience. I think it's a good learning experience, obviously for the patient, because we're running through these aisles and we're talking about food and its role in disease. But I also I learn a lot about them, about what their interests are, where they're falling through the cracks on their choices and how we can begin to correct course. So the food shopping has always been fun. I typically will take four or five patients and off to the market we'll go, or sometimes patients like to do this one-on-one. So we'll do that. Group settings are always beneficial because we learn from one another, and it's wonderful to see how my patients actually become fast friends. Mm. And because again, they're all on the same journey. They're implementing behavior changes in their life. And most of my patients are in their fifth, sixth decade of life. So they're they've been doing what they've been doing for a long time. So now we're introducing something that maybe feels a little bit uncomfortable. And so it's so nice to go on this journey with someone else mm-hmm. to support you. So I love it when my patients will email me and say, we went for a walk today, and they mentioned two or three patients that were in one of our support group meetings. And it's another vehicle by which we can support patients on introducing these lifestyle changes.
For those who don't know, or some of you may know a bit about Dr. Stancic's story, she was a medical doctor who became a patient. And a lot of things change for medical doctors who become patients. Yeah. You learn an awful lot.
Yes.
And you were diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Yeah. I read on the multiple sclerosis website, National MS Society website, nearly a million people are living with MS in the United States. Yeah. We don't know a lot about it. We may have been touched by someone who was diagnosed with it, but it's not the most out there.
Yeah.
Disease that we hear about. Mm-hmm. Medications have been helpful at mediating symptoms and slowing the progression.
Yes.
But you made some dramatic changes.
Yes.
To the point where you're not in a wheelchair, you're not using a cane, you're running marathons, and you're a superwoman. And thanks to lifestyle medicine, and it's all in the book. But what I want to focus on is chapter 4, which is movement. Uh-huh. Because I read some things in there that I've never seen before.
Okay.
That I think are really important. You can describe this better than I can, but when you have multiple sclerosis, it's very difficult to move. Sometimes you're numb. Sometimes you have these tingling feelings. And very often, most doctors will tell you not to move.
Yeah.
And you didn't do that. You decided to move.
Yeah.
And move through pain.
Right.
Yeah. And I want to know how you did that.
Well, you know, the science on that has dramatically changed. So in the 1990s, when we didn't know as much as we know today, doctors felt that exercise could be contributing or worsening the disease. So I was advised to not exercise. And, you know, I was at the time struggling with numbness and heaviness in my legs and neuropathy. So it would feel like, Karen, when I would step down on to the floor, it would feel like I was stepping down on a bed of nails or hot coals. So it was painful to walk. So you can, and as you might imagine, it could be even almost dangerous to engage in physical activity. So I was largely advised to, and the other important and most prevalent symptom in multiple sclerosis is fatigue. That is the number one complaint of MS patients. And so you only have so much energy within a day. And so in many ways, I had to be very careful as to how I was going to expend that energy, because I only had so much. It was like a battery, you know. Fatigue was really in many ways overcoming and very difficult for me. And so exercise wasn't something that, again, my doctors had advised me to do. But as I learned, and you know, of course, my I call it my aha moment that came about 8 years into my disease, where I read some literature that talked about the importance of diet and exercise and lifestyle in chronic diseases and in multiple sclerosis. I, for the first time, connected those two dots. I mean, here I was, this dual board certified physician, attending physician, right? 10 years of my life dedicated to a higher education in the field of medicine. I knew nothing about nutrition or food or how it affected chronic disease or the development of chronic disease. And so when I came across this really by chance, it was like, wow, light just came into the room. Hope suddenly was introduced and at a very dark moment in my life. And so as I, you know, this just opened up this voracious appetite in me to learn as much as I could. And I for hours and days, I'm just sitting in front of a computer and pulling these articles and educating myself. And wondering, how was it that I hadn't learned this in medical school? And how was it that my doctors who were, you know, the top rated MS doctors in the country, how was it that they didn't share this with me? At some point, I knew that I needed to implement changes in my life. And in light of all that I had read, I mean, it was just extraordinary, the vast body of evidence in the literature. So in 2003, when I started to change my diet to a whole food plant-based diet, and I began to exercise. So the first thing with exercise was, how was I going to do it? Because I was walking with a cane or a crutch, and I was unsteady on my feet. Like, what do I do? So the only thing I thought I could do would be a stationary bike, right? So my husband would essentially carry me almost to get onto this bike, and I could do like a minute. And then there's, in the book, I write about this thing called Uthoff's phenomenon. And for those who don't know this, in multiple sclerosis, when your body temperature goes up, the way nerves conduct is compromised. And so you get numbness and you get this tingling. And you become very symptomatic. So that's what would happen to me. After just cycling for a few minutes, I would get this like numbness and pain. And then my husband would help me assist me off. And it would take about 15 to 20 minutes until my body temperature got back up. But at that point, I was concerned, am I damaging? Am I hurting myself? But I knew that I needed to work through this. I knew that this was going to be beneficial. So I continued to every day, Karen, I'd get back on that bike. And I would do another minute and then stop and start again. And it was very, very slow. We talked about the journey, the marathon, and that's what it was. but I didn't give up. It was something that I was committed to because I knew where I was after 8 years of multiple sclerosis and taking 12 medicines. The disease was progressing. I was now in my, you know, my 30s, and I was becoming more and more dependent on the cane, and the medications kept adding on and on and on. And I knew I needed to try something. And this seemed reasonable to me. The evidence was there. I understood the mechanisms. So as a researcher and scientist, I needed to do this. So I kept at it. And by the grace of God, over the months that followed, I started to feel better. And instead of a minute, I could do 3 minutes. And then I could do five. And then I could do a half hour. And I continued to progress until ultimately I had the courage go for that marathon. And in 2010, again, but think about it, 2003 to 2010 in a book, it seems like it went really fast, but that's 7 years and a lot of work to sure. get where I am, to get to that point. But I have to tell you, when I crossed that finish line at that marathon, it felt like the most, one of the most, because I've had a lot of wonderful moments, but one of the most amazing moments in my life, because everything I had done, all these changes that I had implemented in my life, who everyone told me, you're making a mistake, it doesn't make sense, just stay on that medicine, had borne fruit. I had proven them all wrong. And here I was feeling extraordinarily well, medication free. And this year, Karen, in October of 2020, I celebrated 25 years since that diagnosis. And on that day, I walked 25 miles with family and friends. And it was another highlight in my life just to celebrate that moment. I mean, you'd think, you know, you're celebrating the day that you were diagnosed with MS. Who would do that? Well, I would do that because I was told that I would be in a wheelchair within 10 to 20 years. So I feel so blessed. I think there's nothing special about me. There's nothing unique about me. We can all do this. You know, that's the purpose behind making the film. The film was really about sharing my story and sharing this idea of lifestyle medicine, illustrating the fact that this is a discipline and an intervention that is based and founded on a lot of substantive evidence in the literature, that this isn't just, you know, some flaky subjective approach that I'm suggesting here, that there's a lot of evidence that supports this and that we could all do it, that it's simple. The film was really about hopefully bringing attention to the fact that we ignore this altogether in medical school, so that we have these physicians that are out in the world practicing medicine, extraordinary education, and we have made so many advances in technology and in development of medications. All of that is important, but in the absence of practicing and speaking to the power of lifestyle choice and the idea that we can prevent 80% of chronic diseases that we see today in clinical practice, that should be our priority. Prevention should be our number one objective. Prevention, as it says in the Hippocratic Oath, is preferable to cure. But we're not trained that way. We're trained to be what I call disease detectives, right? We're trained on this approach that pathogenesis is primary. So we learn and understand and study the disease process, which of course is important. And I say to the students that we learn to become disease detectives, right? We take these really thorough histories and physicals, we're collecting clues, and then we do blood work and imaging studies, again, collecting clues, ultimately to make a diagnosis. And once we've made that diagnosis, what do? Our plan is, our intervention is what? A pharmaceutical agent, a surgical intervention, or a procedure of some sort. And of course, all of that is important. We need to understand pathogenesis and how to treat disease. But what's missing in all of that, that's only half of the human health continuum. The mirror image or the opposite of that is health and well-being, and that's what we call salutogenesis. Mm-hmm. And salutogenesis is the study of health. We don't learn that in medical school. Mm-hmm. Our healthcare system is not a healthcare system. It's a sick care system.
Salutogenesis, I like that. It has salute.
Salutogenesis is a great Genesis.
Great name.
So that salutogenesis is what's missing in medical school. That's why the book is called What's Missing from Medicine, because we need to bring that aspect to training our physicians. So our physicians are almost getting only half the story when they train.
I'm just curious how you feel today. Do you ever get that, any of that numbness or tingling that you experienced in the early days?
I don't anymore. I can tell you though, Karen, that if I, for example, do a lot of traveling and I'm out of sorts, particularly when I travel to the West Coast because I have a pretty regimented schedule, like in the morning, I wake up at 5 o'clock, I exercise, I have my breakfast, you know, like that whole, I go to bed at 9 o'clock, I'm pretty good about structure with my sleep. When things go off schedule, at times, if I get too fatigued, too stressed, like making sure I get this book and deadlines and all the things that are part of life, sometimes if I skew off what I know I need to do, I might get a little symptomatic. I do. But it's like a little warning sign for me. I know I have to step back and say, mm-hmm. you know what? Sometimes I take on too much. I'll be asked to engage in a particular activity or an event or write an article or do, you know, right now in the midst of COVID, I'm not traveling as much as I used to, but there were times where I would do a speaking engagement, you know, two or three in a month, and that would require travel across the country. And so when you do a lot of that, that can be problematic. So, I mean, I've learned the things I can do and things I can't. So I'm pretty good at knowing what my limitations are.
Especially when we're paying attention, the body gives us messages. Alert,
it sure does.
Pay attention.
It sure does. We have to pay attention, yeah.
We have to pay attention. I know that before my cancer experience in 2006, I was one of these people. You had a few of these phrases in your sleep section in the book, but I would say there's plenty of time for sleeping later. I got through a lot of things not on very little sleep.
Yeah.
And now I can't do that. If I get anything less than 8 hours, I mean, seven, minimal, yeah. I can't function. I just, okay.
Well, you can't do it and you shouldn't do it, even if you could.
I know before I could and feel fine, but my body just says, nope, day off, sorry, rest.
But see, that's the thing. You think you're fine, but you're really not. There's stuff happening that you're not really aware of. And I think that's what happens particularly when we're younger, we don't think we need that much sleep. I hear this all the time from patients who say to me, I only need 5 hours, doc. I only need 6 hours. You don't, you need the 7 to 8. We all do that. Let's all come to that realization. Because if you don't do that, if you don't offer your body that opportunity to replenish and rejuvenate, at some point it's going to catch up with you.
Mm-hmm.
So let's be smart and care for ourselves.
In some ways it's unfortunate because I know a lot of young people in their 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. And they're on a terrible diet.
Yes.
And they say, but I feel great. I feel great. I don't have to do anything. I just feel great. And they don't know what's going on inside.
Yeah.
What's accumulating.
Right. Yeah. And I was diagnosed on October 11th, 1995. If you would have talked to me on October 10th, 1995, I would have been one of those young people telling you, I feel great.
Mm-hmm.
And then the floor fell out from under me.
Did you have no clue beforehand?
I really didn't.
Wow.
I really did. I mean, I think back when I was in medical school that I couldn't get through an exam. You know, exams could be 2-3 hours. But I would have to go to the bathroom, and that was my bladder. That was an early sign that my bladder was probably amiss. I remember as a young woman, at times my toes would tingle when I wore heels. So I just assumed it was my heels. Mm. Probably wasn't. There were little things like that when I look back that, you know, might have been, but no, I mean, I was in the left lane going, you know, 90 miles per hour. I was a third year medical resident, I was just assigned, offered the position of chief resident. So I was so excited about that, planning my fellowship. Becoming a physician was my dream. So I had I felt I had made a lot of sacrifices. I mean, I come from an immigrant family, worked really hard, worked through college and most of medical school to get. So I worked hard and I was finally there, you know, reached the top of the mountain and feeling so good. And then all of a sudden, the diagnosis comes and I'm crushed and I'm mad. Feeling like this isn't fair.
No, why it's not fair.
Like I've done all the right things. I've worked super hard, but maybe a lot of that working super hard, again, in retrospect, fueled this diagnosis. I mean, think about it. I wasn't eating properly. I wasn't sleeping as a medical resident. I was super stressed. You know, it was the perfect formula for the development of something like this.
Denial is a tremendous human trait that does not serve us well. Yeah. And as you were talking, I thought about this before, but when I was diagnosed with cancer and I thought, how could this happen to me? I was this healthy, vibrant 48-year-old. And I thought a lot about it. And I realized my problem started when I was a teenager.
Right.
And I was ignoring them for a long time. And my lifestyle was helping me all along the way, but I still had problems I was not acknowledging.
That you needed to address.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that's an important lesson. When I speak to medical students, because I know how stressful medical training is, just subhuman. I mean, nobody should be working 24 or 36 hours. That's just crazy. It's not beneficial for anyone. Learning is not beneficial for the patient who encounters the doctor who hasn't slept in 24 hours. I mean, who wants to be, evaluated by that doc? I don't. We're not thinking straight when we're sleep deprived. I think that the whole model, not only what we learn in medical school and through our residency, but also how we train needs to be looked at and rebuilt, sort of taking into account that we need to train and raise young, healthy people to practice medicine. Mm-hmm. It is unacceptable that the field of medicine has one of the highest rates of suicide and substance abuse issues and burnout. And isn't that crazy?
It is crazy.
We're the representatives of health in community, and we don't know how to take care of ourselves.
Well, that's a sign to everyone out there that you want to have a doctor who walks the walk and looks and feels healthy. So when you're getting a doctor, you need to interview them, ask them if they had a good sleep, the night's sleep the night before, and ask them a little bit about themselves, because not only do you want the best treatment, but you want someone who is able to treat you and is healthy.
And is healthy. It's so important.
You mentioned supplements briefly.
Yes.
And you have a whole section on it in the book.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing. I was relating a lot to some of the things you talked about in the book, because you mentioned you had a little crisis with supplements. Mm-hmm. And I did too before I was diagnosed with cancer, and my symptoms were becoming more apparent. I'm online looking for everything I can possibly find. And I tried this one digestive enzymes product, which made me feel like just horrible. Yeah. And there are so many things promoted out there that actually can do more harm than good.
Yeah, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. I know this is going to upset a lot of people, but it can be dangerous.
And it can be very dangerous.
That. People don't think of supplements as a drug, it's something that you're ingesting and it has to be metabolized. And what is an important point is that when we develop a medication, like a drug that's approved by the FDA, there's a lot of expectations to get to that approval, right? So it has to go through pharmacokinetics, early studies, preclinical studies is what we call it. Then it goes to phase 1 in healthy individuals, then phase 2, phase 3. You have to actually complete 2 large phase 3 studies and show that your therapy is statistically significant, better than the standard. That's a complicated, and it goes through a lot of checkpoints.
It takes a long time and it's expensive.
Yes. I mean, I know I worked at a pharmaceutical company developing drugs in the field of HIV and hepatitis as an infectious disease physician. So I understand it. It's a very complicated course. And a lot of drugs don't make it because we find there's safety signals and then they get tossed. So, you know, for every 1,000 that we look at, maybe one gets through, you know, something like that. So supplements don't have that scientific rigor, right? And so the FDA doesn't have those. So we have to be very, very careful because we don't really understand a whole lot about the efficacy and safety. So I shared my story in the book, but essentially when I was feeling really good, like 2 years into my lifestyle change, I came across a book written by a physician. I'm not going to mention the book or the physician, but in this book, this person listed a bunch of supplements that he felt were very, very important in optimizing health. So now I'm thinking, wow, I feel great. Maybe if I take these supplements, I'm going to feel even better. This is a legitimate person. There's an M and a D after his last name. He must be good. And, you know, I looked him up, went to an Ivy League school, sound really impressive. Mm-hmm. Well, I started to take these really expensive supplements and weeks went by and I started not feel so good. And I started to feel nauseated. Mm. And then I started to vomit. Mm. Anyway, it turned out that at some point I ended up going to the doctor and had my blood work done and my liver enzymes were sky high. I had something called drug-induced liver injury. People die from that. People end up with liver transplants from that. I found myself hospitalized for 2 weeks. Liver biopsy. Talk of liver transplant. So it was a very scary experience. And what I learned from that was that obviously we have to be very careful. Above all, do no harm. And to date, hear me on this. To date, there is no clinical study that shows that taking supplements is going to offer you anything above and beyond what you can already get by optimizing everything we talked about in this book. It's so simple, with the exception of course, B12, vitamin B12, for those of us, particularly those of us who are strictly plant-based, and then vitamin D for those of us who are not, who are living, like for example, where we are in the Northeast, we're not getting enough sunlight, right? So it's really important. But those are topics that you should discuss with your doctor that you may need a supplement for. But this idea that we need to take bottles and bottles of pills in order to achieve our optimal health, that's just garbage. And it needs, I know people don't want to hear that. And there's a lot of companies that are making a lot of money off selling a promise that is really not deliverable. And nobody wants to think, Karen, that it could be this easy. It is easy. I mean, it's so easy. This is why this book is so easy. And it's not a big book. I mean, you could probably
read it. It's very easy to read. It's
so easy to read. That's because it's so easy. It's so simple, right? It's these lessons are, you know, incredibly simple. We can all do them, but nobody wants to believe it's that easy. And it is. If we could only convince folks that it's just as, and you know, I use the metaphor of the wheel, the lifestyle medicine wheel with the spokes, because again, I think some of us are really good at food. Some of us are really good at exercise, right? Maybe some of us are really good at, I don't know, stress management. We're, you know, but few of us are good at all the spokes, right? And it's so important that we hit every one of those spokes. And you can do it again at your own pace, but it's really important that it's not just about your food, but that you engage in daily physical activity and that you identify what are the stressors in your life and what can you do to address that stream of stress. Are you sleeping well? Understanding what your environment looks like, understanding what good sleep physiology, the bottom line is when you address every aspect of lifestyle, you hit that sweet spot. That's where you just know everything, like all those gears are going and you're moving effectively. So I use the wheel because I love the idea of forward movement, right? And if you had, if you envision that wheel with the six spokes, and maybe two or three of those spokes were sort of wonky, they were sort of misaligned, your forward movement would not be very effective.
I'm wobbling right now.
I know. Well, you're right. It would be a wobbly wheel, and things wouldn't flow so well. So that's another message that I hope I conveyed in the book, is that we really need to pay attention to all these pieces. And when we do, I think that's when you really feel and achieve your best self.
Do you have an opinion on Dr. Terry Wall's paleo protocol? Now, here is another medical doctor, who had multiple sclerosis and turned it around with lifestyle, diet and lifestyle. Yeah. It's slightly different than what you're recommending. Not totally, but slightly.
Yeah. Well, let me just say this. I don't know Dr. Terry Walls, and I really don't know very much about her protocol. So I really wouldn't be able to comment on it. But I understand that there is a paleo component to it. And that, of course, would be incongruent with my recommendations. I don't know that. And again, for me, it's not that you have to be strictly vegan or strictly whole food plant-based. I am. But I think that you're going to reap the great benefit of this if you could just at least be plant-centered or primarily plants. In our society, when I ask you, the average person, I can't ask you because you and I are in the same boat, but if you ask a friend who's not aware or interested in any of this, what did you have for dinner? They'll likely say, I had the chicken, the fish, right? No one's saying I had the cauliflower. Like, you go to a restaurant, right? And people say, what did you get? I had the chicken, the fish.
I had the pumpkin seed encrusted tofu.
Yeah.
There you go. With Brussels sprouts. Yeah. Right.
In our society, it's the animal is the center of the plate. It's the primary player. And then we work around it, right? And then the side dishes are the plants. So the first step that our country needs to take is making the plant the primary player, right? If we could just start there, make the plant the primary constituent of that plate and reduce the animal source, that goes a long, long, long way. So I don't know what Dr. Walls prescribes, but for me, it's about more plants. And I tell you, there's a lot of science now that helps us to understand why plants are important in the management of MS. There's a lot of literature that's been published in the past 5 years that looking at when you eat a plant-based diet, so a diet rich in fiber, right? When you consume that fiber, you're changing up the makeup of the microbiome. And the microbiome is this big colony of organisms, bugs that live, bacteria, virus, and fungi that live in our gut. And we know that we have good bugs and we have bad bugs, right? And guess what the good bugs love? They love fiber. So when we eat lots of plants, lots of fiber, we enrich this population of good bugs. And what we've learned in MS is that when these good bugs are enriched, they produce these signals, these chemicals, these short-chain fatty acids that then these good short-chain fatty acids that then communicate with the immune system, and the immune system tells those cells that might have been attacking myelin in the brain and spinal cord to stop doing that. And it's so amazing because when Roy Swank talked about this in the 1950s, when he said a low-fat plant-based diet would be beneficial for those living with MS, everyone thought he was crazy. I mean, how could what you eat, what you put on your plate, affect an autoimmune disease in your brain and spinal cord? It doesn't make any sense. Now we know.
Now it makes sense.
You eat fiber, it changes the bugs in your gut. The bugs in your gut put out a signal, and that signal affects your immune system, telling it whether or not to attack or keep quiet. How cool is that?
It is very cool.
I love it.
I didn't read Dr. Wall's book. I did watch her TED Talk some time ago. And one of the things that stuck in my mind was that she was researching too. And she realized she needed nutrients. So she started taking a lot of supplements.
Oh.
And then after taking the supplements, she thought, maybe I should be getting these from their original source, and then connected it to plant foods. And she does recommend eating a lot of plant foods.
Wonderful.
And I think one of the key components that's similar in a lot of these dietary protocols today is to eliminate refined foods, fast foods, processed foods, white flour foods, sugar. And yeah. When we all do that, we're already a step in the right direction.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. So it's about reducing animal sources and cutting out those refined processed foods. That's so, so important. If you look at the standard American diet or the SAD diet that we've referred to, we know that 12% of our calories are coming from plants. And actually, if you drill down and you look further, 6% of the 12% is like French fries, you know, the potato and a French fry,
or
the
ketchup.
Apples and ketchup and apples and apple pie, or, you know, so we're, think about that. Our country, about 6% of what we're consuming is actually whole food plant-based. And so that's why we're so sick. That's why we're struggling with obesity. And, you know, I have to mention this because I think it's striking, just to give you a sense. In 1985, the CDC started to collect data in this behavioral risk factor surveillance system, collecting data, obesity rates across the country. So you could look at different states and see what rates of obesity were happening. So when I was writing, when I started writing the book, and I wrote the little excerpt on obesity, at the time, the CDC in 2019 was reporting that the obesity rate was 39.8%. of Americans were obese, right? So in the final round, before the book went to print, I was just checking facts, right? So I went to the CDC website and it was now 42.4%.
And going up.
And think about that, in a year, it climbed by more than 2%. I mean, it's crazy. Just to give you a sense of how quickly it's moving, just when you think it's plateaued, like it can't get worse. I mean, it can't, I think it's 42.3% now. It can't possibly get worse. It will. It will, because it always does. Something dramatic has to happen in medicine. We need to, this message that we are relaying in hopefully in this book, I just pray that it resonates. And it serves to create change. I mean, there's so many of us. The wonderful thing about lifestyle medicine is that it is a field that is growing. It is a movement. There's so many of my wonderful colleagues across the country that are doing extraordinary work. And all of these voices, Karen, are coalescing, and we're creating change, no doubt. But it needs to happen, and it needs to happen soon, because so many are suffering. We're losing so many. And even today, in the midst of this coronavirus pandemic, we know that those who are suffering most severely are those that are living with a pre-existing chronic illness. In fact, the CDC published data that informed us, if you have a chronic disease and then get infected with COVID-19, you're 6 times more likely to be hospitalized and 12 times more likely to die.
Those are big numbers. And you are an infectious disease expert.
Yes.
Specializing in infectious disease. So the recommendations, obviously, for these COVID times are?
Incredibly important that we maintain social distancing, washing our hands regularly, wear your mask when you go out. These are really simple steps that we all need to take, and they need to be taken seriously, because even now, you know, it's striking to me that here we are in December, and we're in the midst of yet another spike. You witnessed March and April in New York City, here in New Jersey.
Just it was crazy back then.
And I never really, honestly, I never envisioned that we would be back where we are today. Thankfully, the mortality rate is better because we've learned so much in regards to how to manage it, but we're still losing a lot of Americans every day and global citizens every day. I pray that this vaccine is soon to be released and is going to make a big difference. But this is what we've experienced in this past year has been something that is near unimaginable, you know.
The most unfortunate thing is that our leaders, our medical professionals, for the most part, have not recommended what you're recommending in this book, which doesn't only apply to multiple sclerosis and autoimmune diseases. It applies to all chronic diseases, and it applies to living a quality life. The six spokes of lifestyle medicine, they are important for all of us, and they are especially important now in times of COVID-19 to really arm ourselves and protect ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. And Karen, I added that preface really just in the past couple of months. My publisher reached out to me. We had a conversation, and I said, I think this is something important that we need to add. And I do say some things that might be a little bit controversial. I talk about obesity. And I think it's something we need to talk about and be honest. This idea that carrying excess weight is acceptable, this is not about cosmesis. That's not important to me. It's about your health and well-being. When we carry excess weight, this is not inert tissue. This is actively producing these pro-inflammatory cytokines that are fueling disease. We need to talk about that. We need to share these messages. It's not about body shaming or, no. You know, I have to say, as women, we grew up under the worst circumstances. We have such bad, particularly our generation of women, we have such bad relationship with food. Remember the fitting into the Jordache jeans and the Tab and the Diet Coke and the food restrictions. You'd be on these diets where you're eating rice cakes and celery sticks and just depriving. We have a
generation. Yeah, I love celery sticks.
Well, you know what I mean. Not when it's all the only thing you can eat.
Yes.
Then it's not good. But just this whole idea of depriving ourselves and not having, not experiencing satiety. Mm-hmm. We need to reimagine our relationship with food. I want women to eat until they feel satiated. I want these beautiful, generous servings, which is what we deserve, not what we learned. And regrettably, I want our daughters and future generations of women in our country to really love themselves and take care of themselves and feed themselves. And
absolutely. Eat. We should have no baggage when we're eating. It should be a joyful, wonderful experience.
Yeah.
Again, I'm looking into your room and I see that you have this piece up on your wall that says eat.
Yes. Yes.
Eat.
Eat.
Eat whole, minimally processed plant foods, of course, but eat.
Yes, right. I mean, but you know what? Because there's that mindset where you're weighing food or you're counting calories. That whole, so many of the women that I see come to me with those questions. Oh, should I measure my food? How much, like how big? You know, that's done so much damage. Enough of that. We're not counting calories. We're not talking about carbs. We're not talking about protein. You know, whenever we talk about, that's another pet peeve of mine, people talking about food as the macronutrients, like where am I getting my protein? Carbs are bad. Throw all of that away. It's like, I wish we could just, you know, it's like a big blackboard and you just want to erase it all and let's start anew. And let's have a peaceful, loving relationship with food. And it's all about eating beautiful, natural foods that are coming from our earth, whole food, plant-based food. Let's enrich our plates with these foods that are curative, they're preventive, and they offer us that opportunity. As I say in the book, and I say this all the time, I hate to sound like a broken record, but to me, it's so important for us to all age gracefully, you know, so that we get to that point, 99, 102, your age is 102 and you've just spent the most amazing day with your family, your loved ones, and then you go to bed that day, Karen, and you don't wake up. That's the happy ending that I wish for everyone. We can all do this. We do not have to be in that nursing home for 2 to 3 years suffering, contracted, wearing a diaper, demented. And I saw this every day. When I was practicing at the VA, you know, I would round in the nursing home at the end of the day and I would see these patients suffering and it just broke my heart, suffering from the sequelae of diabetes, you know, amputated extremities, status post-stroke, Alzheimer's disease, all of these things. We know how to prevent this from happening. We need to deliver this message to whomever is willing to hear it. And hopefully they will implement changes in their life and live their optimal existence and hopefully optimal quality of life.
Dr. Sarai Stancic, I could talk to you forever about salutogenesis, my new favorite word. Before we go, I always read the acknowledgement section. I usually read it first before I start any book. And I just wanted to acknowledge one person who I know that you acknowledge, Dilip Barman.
Yes.
Who is just a wonderful human being. And I was happy to see his name there. He deserves all the kudos and credit that anyone can give him.
Yes.
So that was nice.
Yeah. Well, Dilip's been a great blessing in my life. He came to me during the making of Code Blue and supported that venture. Code Blue would have never been made without Dilip's support. He's so kind throughout all of this. And even throughout writing the book, he's been supportive. And if ever I needed any kind of resource to support, I remember there was a section in the book that were, because one of the questions that comes up is whole, if you're going to eat a whole food plant-based diet, it's way too expensive, right? Mm.
Beans and rice, sorry.
Right. And so I reached out to him and I asked him about, can you give me some good resources? And he did, and gave me some good ideas, and I added those to the book. So he's always been, you know, just he's a good friend and a good man. You're absolutely right.
Very good. Well, Dr. Sarai Stancic, thank you so much for sharing your journey and writing this book. Everyone still, if you haven't seen Code Blue, it's an absolute must assignment. Get this book, share it with everyone.
Thank you.
I have nothing else to add. Thank you. Go forth, do more interviews, share your story.
Thank you, Karen. God bless you. Bye.
Okay, take care.
That was Dr. Sarai Stancic, everybody, the author of the new book, What's Missing from Medicine. I can't say enough good about this book. I wish it had been written over 50 years ago. I could have used it back then to share with a family member. But now we have it, and we can take advantage of it. Read it, share it, and put it into action. What's amazing to me is learning how these chronic diseases that are plaguing us today, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, we know that they are reversible and preventable in most cases. And to add to the list based on courageous people and their research, like the doctors Dean and Ayesha Sherzai, who wrote the book, The Solution to Alzheimer's, we never knew that Alzheimer's could be preventable and in some cases reversible with diet and lifestyle. And now we learn that it's true with multiple sclerosis as well. Probably many, if not all, of the chronic diseases that face us today can be prevented, reversed, or at least the symptoms can be significantly diminished. That's the end of our program today. Thanks for listening. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Please visit responsibleeatingandliving.com, where I live. We keep adding recipes that make this healthy lifestyle so delicious. Have a delicious week.